Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're the place where we dig into a whole heap of fascinating sources to bring you the stuff you really need to know, tailored just for you.
That's right.
And today, we're taking a big trip, a cosmic journey, really, to the biggest planet in the neighborhood.
Jupiter.
Yeah, the king. Our mission today is basically to unpack Jupiter. What makes it tick? You know, how did it even get here? And the huge impact it has on, well, everything else around us.
We've really pulled out some mind-bending facts from our sources, kind of a shortcut to getting up to speed on this giant.
And when we say giant, we absolutely mean it. Get this. Jupiter's mass, it's more than 2.5 times the mass of all the other planets in the solar system put together.
Whoa. Okay, that's hard to even picture.
Right. And its diameter is about 11 times Earth's, or think of it this way, about 1/10 the diameter of the sun itself. It's just huge.
So naturally, it stands out in the night sky.
Oh, definitely. It's the third brightest thing up there after the moon and Venus. People have been watching it since, well, forever, since prehistoric times. And the name Jupiter obviously comes from the Roman king of the gods.
Yep, the chief deity. Makes sense, given its size and brightness.
And you know, the adjective is Jovian, but I found out there's an older word, jovial. Meaning happy or merry. Apparently that came from old astrological ideas about Jupiter being this, like, positive influence.
That's a pretty neat connection, isn't it? How our language reflects those ancient beliefs.
It really is. So, okay, let's talk history. Jupiter's origins. You found something pretty surprising about its age.
I did. This is a big one. Jupiter is likely the oldest planet in the solar system.
Older than Earth.
Way older.
Yeah.
It seems to have formed just maybe 1 million years after the sun itself. That's roughly 50 million years before Earth even got started.
50 million years. Wow. That's a serious head start.
Yeah.
So how did this firstborn actually form? What's the thinking there?
Well, the current model suggests it started forming out beyond the snow line.
Snow line.
Yeah, it's basically the distance from the young sun, where it was cold enough for stuff like water ice, ammonia ice, methane ice, the volatiles to freeze into solid particles.
Okay.
So Jupiter could form a solid core from rock and ice first, maybe 10, 15 times Earth's mass. And then, because it was so massive already, it just started pulling in enormous amounts of hydrogen and helium gas directly from the surrounding nebula before that gas cloud disappeared.
So it built its core, then bulked up incredibly fast with gas.
Exactly. But it didn't just sit there quietly after forming. This is where it gets really interesting with something called the Grand Tack hypothesis.
The Grand Tack? Sounds dramatic. What does that suggest?
It is pretty dramatic. The idea is that Jupiter didn't just form and stay put. It likely started further in, maybe around 3.5 AU. That's 3.5 times Earth's distance from the sun.
Okay.
But then interactions with the gas disk it was embedded in, and also importantly, gravitational nudges from Saturn forming nearby, caused it to actually migrate inwards towards the sun.
Inwards, like a wrecking ball heading for the inner solar system.
Potentially, yeah. Imagine this giant planet moving inwards. It could have completely disrupted any earlier planets, maybe super Earths, that might have formed closer to the sun, just smashed them up or thrown them out.
That's chaotic. So what stopped it? Why isn't it orbiting near Mercury?
Well, that's the tack part. Saturn was also forming and migrating inwards, but it moved faster. Eventually, they fell into this special orbital lock, a resonance 3.2 resonance, meaning Jupiter went around twice for every 3 times Saturn did.
Like they were gravitationally linked.
Precisely. And this specific resonance actually changed the dynamics. It caused both planets to reverse their migration and start moving outward again, away from the sun.
Like a cosmic U-turn.
Kinda, yeah. A big, slow U-turn over maybe 3 to 6 million years. And this outward journey is key. It likely cleared out the region where the terrestrial planets, including Earth, eventually formed from the leftover rocky material.
So Jupiter's crazy dance might be why we even have Earth here today.
It's a very compelling idea. It explains a lot about the structure of our solar system. But, you know, it's important to say it's still a hypothesis. There are some tricky bits, like matching the timing perfectly with how we think Earth formed.
Right.
And there are other models, too. Some suggest Jupiter formed much, much further out, maybe 30 or 40 AU, and then migrated in over hundreds of thousands of years. The early solar system was definitely a dynamic place.
It sounds like it. Are there other big theories about Jupiter's influence back then?
Yeah, there's the NICE model, N-I-C-E, after the city in France where it was developed. That model suggests later migrations of Jupiter and Saturn disrupted Uranus and Neptune, sending them outwards, and maybe triggered the late heavy bombardment, that period of intense impacts on the inner planets.
Wow.
And there's even a wilder idea called the Jumping Jupiter scenario. This suggests Jupiter's migration could have been so disruptive it actually kicked a whole fifth giant planet right out of the solar system.
A fifth gas giant. Seriously.
That's the theory. It makes you wonder what our solar system could have looked like.
Definitely. Okay, let's shift from its past to its present. Let's dive inside Jupiter. We call it a gas giant, but that's a bit misleading, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, its main ingredients, hydrogen and helium, are gases under normal conditions. But inside Jupiter, under crushing pressure and temperature, they don't behave like gases at all.
And the scale is just hard to grasp.
It really is. That diameter, nearly 143,000 kilometers, you could fit, what, over 1,300 Earths inside it by volume?
But it's not very dense. I read something about sugar syrup.
Yeah. Its average density is surprisingly low, only about 1.3 times that of water. So yeah, kind of like thick syrup overall, much less dense than Earth.
So what's actually inside, if not just gas?
Well, the outer atmosphere is mostly hydrogen, maybe 76%, and helium, about 24% by mass. But as you go deeper, the mix changes slightly, getting denser, maybe 71% hydrogen, 24% helium, and a bigger chunk, about 5% of other heavier elements.
And the core? Is it rocky like Earth's?
That's where things get really weird, thanks largely to NASA's Juno mission. It doesn't seem to have a small, solid core like we expected. Instead, it looks like it has a diffuse core, or maybe a fuzzy core.
Diffuse.
Meaning the heavy elements aren't all packed into the very center. They seem to be mixed up into the lower part of the mantle, maybe spanning out to 30 or even 50% of the planet's radius.
Huh?
And the total mass of these heavy elements could be anywhere from, say, 7 to 25 times the entire mass of Earth.
Wow, so it's a huge spread out core. What about the hydrogen further up?
Well, as you go deeper, the incredible pressure forces the hydrogen molecules so close together that their electrons get squeezed off. It transitions from a normal molecular fluid into a metallic fluid.
Metallic hydrogen.
Yeah, it conducts electricity like a metal. So deep inside Jupiter, you might have this vast ocean of liquid metallic hydrogen, maybe mixed with other stuff, behaving in equally strange, super critical ways.
An ocean of liquid metal. And I heard something about rain inside Jupiter. Not water, obviously.
Right. It's thought that helium and also neon, which are less soluble in metallic hydrogen at those extreme conditions, actually condense into droplets and rain down deeper into the planet.
Helium rain.
Yeah, which would explain why the upper atmosphere seems a bit depleted in helium compared to what we'd expect from the sun's composition.
Okay, that's wild. But I also heard diamonds. Is that real?
That's the really astonishing idea. The theory goes that the intense pressure deep inside can compress carbon atoms, maybe from methane breaking down, directly into diamonds. Solid diamonds that would then rain down even deeper.
Diamond rain. Okay, yep. That's incredible.
It's thought to happen on Saturn, too, and maybe Uranus and Neptune. It really highlights the exotic chemistry happening inside these giants.
And Jupiter's incredibly hot inside, right? Radiating more heat than it gets from the sun.
It is. It gives off nearly twice as much heat as it absorbs from sunlight. This isn't nuclear fusion like a star, though. It's called the Kelvin-Helmholtz mechanism.
Okay, what's that, simply?
Basically, Jupiter is so massive that its own gravity is causing it to slowly, very slowly contract. And like squeezing a bicycle pump makes it hot. This immense gravitational contraction generates heat deep inside, which then radiates out.
So it's shrinking.
Yes. By about maybe a millimeter or two per year, which doesn't sound like much, but it means Jupiter was actually significantly larger in the past, maybe twice its current diameter when it was very young and hot.
So it was bigger, hotter, radiating its own heat. Was it ever close to being a star? A failed star?
That's a common question. And, you know, compared to Earth, it's enormous. But compared to a star, not even close. You'd need about 75 times Jupiter's current mass to get enough pressure and heat at the core to ignite hydrogen fusion.
Okay. So definitely a planet, albeit a huge and hot one.
It's a very huge, internally heated planet, yes. Not a star.
Let's talk about that atmosphere then. Because you can't discuss Jupiter without the Great Red Spot.
Absolutely iconic. It's this gigantic, persistent storm, an anticyclone, technically, much bigger than Earth itself.
And it's been raging for centuries.
We have reliable observations back to 1831. Some earlier possible sightings go back to the 1660s, though it's hard to be sure if it was the same spot.
What actually is it? And why is it red?
Still some mystery there. We know it rotates counterclockwise, taking about 6 Earth days to complete a turn. The red color While the best guess involves complex chemistry high up, maybe sunlight breaking down ammonia ice particles, which then react with other chemicals like acetylene, but it's not fully settled.
And it's shrinking, right?
Dramatically.
Yeah.
Back in the late 1800s, it was estimated to be over 40,000 kilometers across. By 2015, it was more like 16,500 by 11,000 kilometers.
Wow.
It's shrinking noticeably by almost 1,000 kilometers per year in length. We don't know if it will eventually disappear or stabilize.
And how deep does it go? Did Juno figure that out?
It did. That was a big finding. Juno's instruments measured its roots, basically. It extends downwards somewhere between 300 and 500 kilometers.
500 kilometers deep. That's staggering for a storm.
Much deeper than any storm system on Earth, yes. Deeper than Earth's oceans, even.
Beyond the spot, you have those characteristic bands across Jupiter.
Mm.
The zones and belts.
Right. The visible clouds are mostly ammonia ice crystals. The lighter colored bands are called zones. They're regions of rising gas. The darker ones are belts, regions of sinking gas. And at the boundaries between them, you get incredible turbulence and jet streams with winds whipping around at, you know, over 100 meters per second easily. That's hundreds of kilometers per hour.
And lightning. Is it like Earth lightning?
Bigger. Much bigger. Jupiter's lightning strikes can be up to 1,000 times more powerful than ours.
Whoa.
And Juno found something cool, shallow lightning. It seems to originate relatively high up, maybe from processes involving ammonia water slush, these sort of mush balls that form and then fall deeper.
Mush balls causing lightning.
Yeah. And even higher up, in the very upper atmosphere, we've detected these fleeting, bright flashes things called spites or elves. They're similar to phenomena seen above thunderstorms on Earth, but, you know, on a Jovian scale. Blue or pink flashes lasting just milliseconds.
Jupiter's atmosphere sounds incredibly active. What about this great cold spot I read about?
Yeah, another discovery, this one near the North Pole. It's this huge patch, maybe 24,000 kilometers across. That's about 200 degrees Celsius colder than the surrounding atmosphere.
Colder? Why?
The leading idea links it to Jupiter's powerful aurora, which is driven by interactions with its magnetic field and particles from its moon, Io. It might be creating this persistent cold vortex somehow, still being studied.
Okay, you mentioned the magnetic field. Just how strong is it?
It's the undisputed champion. By far the strongest planetary magnetic field in the solar system. About 14 times stronger than Earth's at the cloud tops, but its overall influence of the magnetosphere is immense.
How immense?
It stretches millions of kilometers toward the sun, and on the downstream side, the magnetotail extends out so far it can actually reach past the orbit of Saturn.
Past Saturn. That's incredible.
It really is. And it has fascinating interactions, especially with the moon, Io.
Io, the volcanic one.
Exactly. Io's volcanoes spew out tons of sulfur dioxide gas. This gas gets stripped away and ionized electrically charged, forming a huge donut-shaped cloud of plasma called the Io Plasma Torus that orbits Jupiter.
Okay.
And the interaction between Io, this plasma torus, and Jupiter's spinning magnetic field generates incredibly powerful electrical currents and radio waves.
Radio waves, like we can detect them.
Oh, yeah. Jupiter is one of the brightest radio sources in the sky after the sun. Sometimes, when things align just right, the radio emissions from this Io-Jupiter interaction can actually outshine the sun at certain radio frequencies.
So Jupiter's basically broadcasting its magnetic power across space.
You could say that, yeah. It's a powerful natural radio transmitter.
And what about rings? Does Jupiter have rings like Saturn?
It does, but they're very different. They're extremely faint and tenuous, not bright and icy like Saturn's. Jupiter's rings are mostly made of fine dust particles.
Dust. Where does it come from?
It's thought to be kicked up by micrometeoroid impacts on Jupiter's small inner moons, like Adrastea, Metis, Thebe, and Amalthea. Jupiter's powerful gravity then shapes this dust into the ring system we see. So, more like dusty halos than grand ice rings.
Interesting distinction. Okay, let's talk about Jupiter's place in the solar system, its cosmic dance. You mentioned another mind-blowing fact about its center of mass with the sun.
Oh, right, the barycenter. This is pretty cool. For every other planet, the common center of mass it shares with the sun lies inside the sun. But Jupiter is so massive.
Yes.
That the Jupiter-Sun barycenter actually lies slightly outside the sun's surface, about 7% of the sun's radius above the surface, actually.
So technically, Jupiter doesn't orbit the exact center of the sun. They both orbit this point just outside the sun.
Exactly. It really shows just how much gravitational pull Jupiter exerts, making the sun itself do a little wobble around that external point.
That's a great way to visualize its influence.
Mm-hmm.
And it spins incredibly fast, right?
Fastest rotation of any planet. One day on Jupiter is less than 10 Earth hours long. And that rapid spin is what causes it to bulge out at the equator quite noticeably. You can even see it's not perfectly spherical through a decent telescope. Its equatorial diameter is significantly larger than its polar diameter.
And seasons, does it have them?
Not really significant ones. Its axial tilt is tiny, only about 3 degrees compared to Earth's 23.5, or so no major seasonal variations like we experience.
Okay, so its gravity makes the sun wobble. It spins super fast. How else does it shape the solar system?
Oh, profoundly. Its gravity is like the grand sculptor of the system. It influences the orbits of all the other planets, tending to pull them closer to its own orbital plane, which is slightly different from the sun's equatorial plane.
And the asteroid belt.
Huge influence there. It creates the Kirkwood gaps, these zones within the main asteroid belt, where there are very few asteroids. Those are regions where an asteroid would orbit in resonance with Jupiter, maybe twice for every one Jupiter orbit, or 3 times for every two, stuff like that.
And Jupiter's gravity just kicks them out.
Over time, yes. The repeated gravitational nudges make those orbits unstable, clearing out the gaps. And as we mentioned, its migrations might have triggered the late heavy bombardment, scattering asteroids and comets throughout the early solar system.
Right. And it also traps asteroids, doesn't it? The Trojans?
Yes. Those are fascinating. Asteroids get trapped in Jupiter's Lagrange, points these gravitationally stable spots 60 degrees ahead of and 60 degrees behind Jupiter in its orbit.
So they just follow it around forever.
Pretty much. There are two huge swarms of them called the Greek camp ahead and the Trojan camp behind, named after figures from the Trojan War, thousands of them locked in this gravitational dance with Jupiter.
Now, this leads to the popular idea of Jupiter as the solar system's vacuum cleaner, protecting Earth by gobbling up or deflecting dangerous comets and asteroids. Is that accurate?
That's a great question, and it's complicated and debated. On the one hand, Jupiter's immense gravity well does mean it gets hit far more often than Earth, maybe 200 times more impacts from asteroids and comets. We saw that spectacularly with Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 back in 1994, right?
Yeah, I remember seeing those images. Huge dark scars on Jupiter.
Exactly. It broke apart and slammed into Jupiter piece by piece. So it definitely acts as a shield sometimes, taking hits that might otherwise reach the inner solar system.
Bullet.
But recent computer simulations suggest it's not quite that simple. While Jupiter does eject many comets from the solar system and capture others, its gravity can also perturb objects onto paths that cross Earth's orbit.
Ah, so it can sling things towards us too.
It seems possible, yeah. It might not cause a net decrease in the number of potential impactors for Earth. It might just stir the pot, so to speak. Some scientists argue it's as much a sniper as a shield.
So the vacuum cleaner idea might be too simplistic.
It probably is. The reality of its gravitational influence is more nuanced and maybe a bit more dangerous in some ways. It's still an active area of research.
Fascinating. It shows how much our understanding keeps evolving. Let's trace that evolution. How did humans first view Jupiter?
Well, being so bright, it was known since antiquity. Babylonian astronomers, as far back as the 7th or 8th century BC, were keeping detailed records of its movements, noting its roughly 12-year cycle through the zodiac.
And the Chinese.
They also tracked it closely, calling it the year star, Suikjing, because its 12-year orbit roughly matched the 12-year cycle of their earthly branches, part of their traditional calendar and zodiac.
And there was that claim about seeing a moon even before telescopes.
Right. The intriguing, though difficult to verify, claim that the Chinese astronomer Gan Dei might have spotted one of the largest moons with his naked eye way back in the 4th century BC, nearly 2,000 years before Galileo. It's possible, under perfect conditions, for someone with exceptional eyesight.
Wow. And those moons later became key for something else fundamental, right? The speed of light.
They did. In the 1670s, the Danish astronomer Ole Rømer made incredibly careful observations of the timings of when Jupiter's moons passed behind the planet. He noticed that these eclipses seemed to happen later when Earth was farther away from Jupiter in its orbit and earlier when Earth was closer. He correctly deduced this delay was due to the time it took light to travel the extra distance.
So he used Jupiter's moons as a sort of cosmic clock to measure light speed.
Exactly. It was one of the first quantitative estimates for the speed of light, a brilliant piece of observational astronomy.
Then came the telescope and Galileo. That changed everything.
Absolutely. In 1610, Galileo turned his newly improved telescope towards Jupiter and saw 4 points of light orbiting it: the Galilean moons, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto.
which was huge
Because it showed celestial bodies orbiting something other than Earth. It was a massive blow to the old geocentric model where everything supposedly revolved around us. Strong evidence for Copernicus's heliocentric view.
Did anyone else see them around the same time?
Yes, Simon Marius in Germany observed them independently around the same time, maybe even slightly earlier, and he's the one who gave them their mythological names, which stuck. Though Galileo's publication got more attention initially.
And other early telescope discoveries.
Well, others soon started seeing more detail. Fontana observed the bands or belts in the 1630s. Cassini saw spots, including possibly the Great Red Spot, noted the planet's oblate, squash shape, and even realized different parts rotated at different speeds differential rotation.
And they kept finding more moons, too.
Slowly, yes. E. Barnard visually discovered the fifth moon, Amalthea, in 1892 using the powerful Lick Observatory Telescope. That was actually the last planetary moon found purely by visual observation through a telescope.
Then came a whole new way of seeing Jupiter radio astronomy.
Right, a huge leap in 1955. Bernard Burke and Kenneth Franklin were trying to map radio sources in the sky and accidentally detected these strong, sporadic bursts of radio waves coming from Jupiter.
They just stumbled upon it.
Pretty much, it was unexpected. And these radio bursts helped astronomers nail down Jupiter's true rotation period, the one tied to its magnetic field, which is slightly different from the rotation period of its visible clouds.
And we now know there are different kinds of radio signals.
Yeah, three main types. Those powerful decametric bursts, often linked to Io's position, smoother decimetric emission from high-energy electrons trapped in its radiation belts, and thermal radiation, basically just the heat coming from its deep atmosphere. Radio opened a whole new window.
But the really detailed views came from sending spacecraft there.
Oh, absolutely. The robotic explorers completely revolutionized our understanding.
Starting with the Pioneers.
Yep, Pioneer 10 and 11 flew past in 1973 and 1974. They gave us our first close-up images and, crucially, discovered Jupiter's intense radiation belts much stronger than expected, almost fried the spacecraft.
Then the Voyagers.
Voyager 1 and 2 in 1979 were game changers. Much better cameras, more instruments. They revealed the complexity of the moons, discovered the faint rings, confirmed the Great Red Spot was an anticyclonic storm, saw volcanic plumes on Io. Just a treasure trove of data.
And other flybys happened too.
Yeah, Ulysses used Jupiter for a gravity assist in 92 to get into a solar polar orbit. Cassini flew by on its way to Saturn in 2000, and New Horizons zipped past heading to Pluto in 2007. Each gave us more great data and images.
But the first dedicated mission orbiting Jupiter was Galileo, right?
Yes, the Galileo mission arriving in 1995 after a long journey. It was a two-part mission, an orbiter and an atmospheric probe.
A probe that went into Jupiter's atmosphere.
It did. It plunged into the clouds, deployed its parachute, and transmitted data for about an hour as it descended roughly 150 kilometers before the heat and pressure destroyed it.
What did it find?
Incredible data. Confirmed the high abundance of hydrogen, measured temperatures over 300 degrees Celsius, and clocked wind speeds over 640 kilometers per hour, even deep down. It gave us our only direct sampling of Jupiter's atmosphere so far.
And the orbiters studied the whole system for years.
Until 2003, it made detailed observations of Jupiter and especially its large moons. Its mission ended with a deliberate plunge into Jupiter itself to ensure it couldn't possibly contaminate Europa, which might harbor life.
A necessary precaution. And now we have Juno.
Juno, orbiting since 2016. It's in this highly elliptical polar orbit, dipping close over the poles, then swinging far out. This lets it map Jupiter's gravity and magnetic fields with incredible precision and peer beneath the clouds using microwave instruments.
What are some of its big finds?
That fuzzy core we talked about, measuring the depth of the Great Red Spot, getting the first images of the poles, discovering that shallow lightning, it's really rewriting the book on Jupiter's interior and atmosphere.
And this mission is ongoing.
Yes, it's in an extended mission now, making targeted flybys of the Galilean moons as well. Like Galileo, it's planned to end its life with a controlled deorbit into Jupiter, probably sometime in 2025.
And the future. We're sending more missions.
Definitely. The focus is shifting significantly towards the icy moons, especially Europa. ESA's JUICE mission, Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, launched in 2023,
Okay.
and NASA's Europa Clipper launched in 2024. Both are heading to the Jupiter system to make detailed studies of Ganymede, Callisto, and particularly Europa, looking for evidence of subsurface oceans and assessing their potential habitability.
So the moons are becoming almost as big a draw as Jupiter itself.
In many ways, yes. Especially in the search for life beyond Earth.
Let's wrap up with those Galilean moons then. Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto. They're not just small satellites, are they?
Not at all. They're planet-sized worlds in their own right. Ganymede is larger than Mercury. You can spot them easily with binoculars from Earth, little points of light dancing around Jupiter.
And they interact with each other gravitationally in a special way.
The inner three, Io, Europa, and Ganymede, are locked in what's called a Laplace resonance. It's a stable orbital configuration where for every four times Io orbits Jupiter, Europa orbits exactly twice, and Ganymede orbits exactly once.
A 4.2.1 resonance. What does that do?
It means they give each other regular gravitational tugs at the same points in their orbits. This constant rhythmic pulling forces their orbits to be slightly elliptical, not perfectly circular.
And that slight non-circularity is important.
Hugely important, because as they move closer and farther from Jupiter in their elliptical orbits, Jupiter's immense gravity stretches and squeezes them. This constant flexing, called tidal heating, generates enormous amounts of heat in their interiors.
Ah, so that's the engine driving Io's volcanoes.
Precisely. Io is the most volcanically active body in the entire solar system, with hundreds of volcanoes constantly erupting lava and sulfur compounds. It's all powered by this relentless tidal heating from Jupiter, amplified by the resonance with Europa and Ganymede.
And for Europa, what does the tidal heat do there?
For Europa, the heat is thought to be enough to maintain a vast ocean of liquid water beneath its icy shell. Its surface is also geologically very young, smooth, with few craters, suggesting it's being constantly resurfaced, perhaps by water or slush erupting from below.
Which is why it's such a prime target in the search for life.
Exactly. That potential subsurface ocean, kept warm by tidal heating, is one of the most compelling places to look for extraterrestrial life in our solar system.
Ganymede and Callisto?
Ganymede, the biggest moon, also shows signs of past geological activity and even has its own magnetic field, likely generated in a liquid iron core, possibly also with the subsurface ocean. Callisto is further out, less affected by tidal heating, heavily cratered, and perhaps less active, but still a fascinating icy world. They're really a miniature solar system orbiting Jupiter.
What an amazing journey through the Jovian system. We've covered so much from Jupiter being the likely firstborn planet.
Yeah, it's dramatic migration shaping the solar system.
It's bizarre interior with metallic hydrogen and maybe diamond rain.
It's wild atmosphere, the shrinking great red spot, the powerful magnetic field.
Its role as maybe both a shield and a sniper for Earth.
And humanity's centuries-long quest to understand it. From ancient eyes to modern spacecraft.
Culminating in the incredible discoveries about its potentially life-harboring moons.
It really puts our own planet in perspective, doesn't it? Seeing this giant system operating on such grand scales.
It absolutely does. So here's a final thought to leave you with. We know Jupiter's gravity is this immense force, sculpting orbits, potentially protecting us, maybe sometimes endangering us. What does that constant interplay, that delicate gravitational balance, tell us about how solar systems like ours evolve over billions of years? And how does understanding that complex dance influence where and how we search for life elsewhere? Is stability the norm, or is constant change and disruption more common out there?
Yeah, deep questions. Makes you look at that bright point of light in the sky a little differently.
Definitely food for thought. Go out and see if you can spot it tonight.